Welcome to Politico Money. I'm Ben White. One of the beefs I have with the baby boom generation is the financial legacy they're leaving us. For example, retirement and Social Security.
As a little sneak preview, I'm part of the baby boom. I'm now receiving Social Security. I'm Social Security age.
Social Security will pay all the money. They always have and they always will.
Am I sure about my retirement? I mean, absolutely not. Are you?
I think a lot of people consider millennials a little privileged, but I've been working two jobs. So yeah, I guess that's where I stand on that.
Okay, so what's the future of programs like Social Security? And what the heck are we going to do about the $22 trillion national debt? $22 trillion. Seriously. It's impossible to even conceive of a number quite that big. It's going to take a lot of political will to fix these big problems. Something we really don't have much of right now. To be honest, we have no will at all. Deficits are now running again at $1 trillion a year. But there was a time when maybe it seemed like we had a plan.
I always believed, and the president always believed, that the grand bargain, as you describe it, would probably be an easier bill to pass in both houses of the Congress. And you could do it on a bipartisan basis.
So in this episode of Baby Bust, we're going to jump in the Wayback Machine to the summer of 2011. We actually, shocker, tried to fix all these big fiscal issues, or at least take a reasonable stab at it.
But understand, we never got to the grand bargain. Why? Because it never got to be grand.
And we're going to do it with Politico editor and my boss, Carrie Budoff Brown, because she was there. Carrie was White House correspondent back in the so-called glory days of 2011 when President Barack Obama and then House Speaker John Boehner tried to reach something called a grand bargain. So what did that mean? What was the grand bargain?
Well, the grand bargain is meant to be something that is so big.
It was really big, really difficult, and demanded.
Demands and requires pain from both parties. And that's why it's called a grand bargain, to solve these really big issues back in the day and even today, really. The thought was that it would be easier to go big on a package that extracts, you know, tough things from both parties versus just doing a small package. Cutting $2 billion from the budget was seen as a difficult task. Perhaps let's go bigger and demand that Republicans give up something big, Democrats give up something big, we hold hands and jump off the cliff together. That was the idea of a grand bargain.
Right. And we were talking about, trying to cut the deficit and shore up Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. And then President Obama was asking Boehner and Republicans to swallow something that they really didn't want to, which was, you know, increased revenues, essentially increased taxes. And somehow if you put that whole package together, you get a big deficit reduction, and then you get, you know, longer term health for Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and a little more revenue coming into the government. So, you know, a grand bargain, pain on all sides. I guess, you know, remind us kind of how dire the situation was, you know, on the spending side, on the entitlement piece of this. Like, what were they trying to do? What were they trying to fix?
Well, I think we should even go back a little bit further. I mean, I think the reason the country got to this point, I mean, it started in 2010 when the president lost control of the House. And then you had Republicans trying to use the debt limit. It was a routine function of Congress to raise the debt limit every so often. And the debt limit was coming due in early 2011. And you had this refusal on the part of House Republicans to just give, as they said, a blank check to the president to spend. And because of that refusal, it was forcing Barack Obama and the House Republicans to engage in a process of, in order for the president to get a debt limit increase, it was being demanded of him that he cut from the budget. And, this was anathema to the president and to a lot of Democrats, the idea that you would just sort of slice so deeply, you know, and that's why they got to this point where, you know, faced with the prospect of not raising the debt ceiling, that you had them having to sort of go down this road of this sort of big deal. And, that's where we ended up in the summer of 2011 because the debt ceiling was about to expire. It needed to be raised. Republicans weren't going to give it to the president unless he cut, you know, billions of dollars from the budget. He didn't want to do that. That's when, you know, you had a period of time where you had a short period of negotiations. Joe Biden and Eric Cantor were trying to come up with just a deal, raise the debt limit in exchange for $2 billion or so in cuts. They couldn't get it done. And, you know, unknown to Eric Cantor, the president reached out to John Boehner following their, you know, following their golf game, this famous golf game that they had in June of 2011.
There are a lot of issues that divide the president and the speaker. The War Powers Act, the threat to cut off funding for U.S. operations in Libya, the debt limit ceiling. And those aren't likely to get settled on the golf course tomorrow, but maybe that round of golf will help.
They decided then to sort of go off and do these negotiations on their own quietly to come up with a big plan because the small version of what they had to do just wasn't going to get done.
Yeah, I want to get to the Boehner-Obama bromance in a second, starting with that golf game, the famous golf game.
Playing golf with someone is a great way to really get to know someone. You start trying to hit that little white ball, you can't be somebody that you're not because all of you shows up.
Yeah. So the big rap on the president in the first 2 years of office was that he didn't golf with Republicans and he didn't try to use golf to connect with his opponents in the Capitol. And, you know, it reached like a fever pitch. Like, is the president going to ask John Boehner to play golf? It was like a big storyline. Like, that's what was passable for big scandals back in the Obama years was the golf. Is he going to golf with John Boehner? And it became like a big fevered like conversation in Washington. And I remember my colleague, Glenn Thrush, he broke the story of the golf game. And that was big news.
Right.
Barack Obama and his nemesis in Washington, Republican Speaker of the House John Boehner, communing over 18 holes of golf. A game that author Mark Twain once derided as a good walk spoiled.
That's really big news. And yeah, it was like that first step. And that was a very sort of pivotal moment. They went to Andrews Air Force Base. They played golf. The president used to go to Andrews Air Force Base all the time. He brought John Boehner with him. They had a cocktail in the clubhouse and they decided to start negotiating. And it really was a moment that I think both men were thinking about their legacies. John Boehner certainly was. He was looking at his own time leading the House. Was he going to be a transformational figure or was he just going to be the guy who barely could control a very fractious caucus? And he wanted, I think he was looking at the, you know, seeing the end of his time in Washington, in the near distance. And he wanted to do something big. He's a Republican that does feel a little bit scarce in Washington now, and that, you know, he wanted to do things and work across the aisle. And he was, even in that stage, he was a very isolated, figure in Washington because he did embark on that process secretly with the president. Even Boehner's deputy, Eric Cantor, did not know about these negotiations that started. Eric Cantor only found out when Joe Biden, let it slip in conversation. And, you know, once you had that happen, the pressure, so it was almost like a celebrity marriage, you know, or celebrity. I almost see it like a celebrity, like dating thing, like, you know, Meghan Markle and Prince Harry, they try to date for like 6 months without the prying eyes of the press and paparazzi and that, you know, start making things complicated. I think the president and John Boehner really were hoping they would have that quiet space to get to know each other and strike a deal. And of course, nothing stays very quiet in the Capitol for long. And they were found out. But, you know, nonetheless, they were sort of off and running on what was, you know, just a couple of weeks of intensive talks trying to get to a big deal. And it was just, like I said, a celebrity marriage or relationship. It was stormy. Ups and downs, calls not being returned, people walking away from each other for days at a time. But it was a fascinating time. But the bromance itself, you know, I think these two figures, I think they, you know, I would hear for years after that, you know, the president always really liked John Boehner. John Boehner liked Barack Obama, but neither believed that the other could get you know, done what they needed to get done. And it was one of sort of the great missed opportunities, I think, that both camps still see to this day.
Indeed. And, you know, as soon as it kind of became public, obviously the pressure on each of their wings increased with, you know, Progressive saying, how dare you talk about Social Security cuts or raising the Medicare retirement age or any of the rest of it. And Cantor and other Republicans being really skeptical of Boehner doing any kind of deal with this, you know, Democratic president. But there was a period of time there, and I remember it in 2011 when these talks were happening, that there was a real sense that there's an opportunity here and something might actually happen. Like there might be this big grand bargain that starts to address some of these structural problems in both the government and in the economy. Did you have that sense like early on in these talks that this might actually get done? Like these guys might pull it off?
You know, there was definitely a sense that when you had two people in the room like John Boehner and Barack Obama, that there was possibly a pathway to doing it for sure. I mean, I remember that summer because it was the summer that I just rediscovered Bananarama. Cruel summer. I literally rediscovered that song that summer, and it was so appropriate for the moment. I listened to Cruel Summer on my iPod as I would go walk around back and forth from the Capitol to the White House. And so I rediscovered Cruel Summer that summer because it was a cruel summer. And I spent a lot of weekends at the White House because it would always seem like we would reach these breaking points around the weekend. It was a sort of a nonstop process of, you know, fits and starts on talks. But there was this period in mid-July where, yeah, it looked like for a couple of days that they had a deal. They had a deal in principle and they were going to get there. But, you know, in retrospect, though, it's obviously clear, you know, why it was perilous and why it may never have happened. But for a period of time, it did look like it. And there's been a lot of, you know, examination of that period, stories and spin told on either side about what actually happened and how it broke down.
Obviously, they never got to a final deal that everybody could agree to, but the goal was kind of clear, like how much they wanted to cut the deficit and what they wanted to do on entitlements. Like, remind us a little bit of, you know, if there were a grand bargain, what it would have done.
So each side had to agree to something they just would never want to agree to otherwise, which for Democrats, that meant cuts in Medicare and Medicaid. For John Boehner and Republicans, it had to be for the first time in decades, agree to massive increase in tax revenues that could come into the, you know, United States Treasury.
About a week before the debt ceiling was to expire, and the president asked Mr. Cantor and I to come into the Oval Office, where we basically sealed the deal.
Where the president and John Boehner got to in that one moment, I think, when they felt like they could get a deal, was that John Boehner agreed to raise taxes. He agreed to, you know, there was some sort of, way to spin what he was doing. It wasn't actually going to be tax increase. It was just going to be you're going to get more revenue. Believe me, it's all the same thing in a lot of ways. But for a couple of days, John Boehner had agreed to raise more tax revenue. The president had agreed to cuts of Medicaid and Medicare. They seemed like they had something. They were also going to cut, they were going to look for ways to deal with Social Security, which was also a huge concession. Republicans and Democrats for a long time, or Democrats in particular, never wanted to bring Social Security into the picture because they say it actually doesn't have anything to do or is not as big of an issue as Medicare and Medicaid. It's self-funded through payroll taxes. But, you know, there was a lot there. It was a big package. And what you had was Democrats would say a misunderstanding. Republicans would say that the president moved the goalposts at the last minute. And what that means is that the president, while they were sort of exchanging these offers in that one week of July, trying to get to the point where they can announce something, the president raised the prospect of bringing in even more tax revenue, raising taxes or bringing in more tax dollars than John Boehner had offered in his last proposal. And, this is sort of the crux of the disagreement, but that is what broke down the process. They had sort of gotten, John Boehner got fed up with the president.
Not one time did the administration ever put any plan on the table.
Exactly. Yeah, and this is where we get to the why won't you return my calls, John Boehner, period.
I think personally, Speaker Boehner probably wanted to do something. He just couldn't control his caucus.
Obama thought that, you know, maybe they're going to get to the altar and consummate this marriage and move on to this grand bargain. And then, you know, he's placing calls to Boehner and those calls are not getting returned. What happened there?
You know, President Obama wanted to talk about this idea of raising more revenue, and the president thought he would hear back from John Boehner. That's how they operated for weeks before that. One would call the other, get him on the phone, vice versa. But suddenly, John Boehner wouldn't come to the phone. And for a short period of time, maybe about 2 days, there was no contact. And just like a relationship, when they don't call back, they're just not that into you. And he and John Boehner had basically decided he was over it. And but it was this, I remember reporting on it at the time. It was a really sort of sad situation for the president, because he was literally like, John Boehner won't return my calls. He called that Friday, I believe it was a Friday. He called over to John Boehner's office, asked to talk to him. He was told that John Boehner could not come to the phone or that he would call him back. And the president said, no, I need to speak with John Boehner now. And they said no. And at around the same time, John Boehner and his staff, were briefing reporters on how the deal fell apart.
And then
I said, Mr. President, you know I can't do this. We've been talking about this for months. I'm already out as far out on a limb as I can get. And you know it. Why are you doing this?
And didn't Obama go into the briefing room that day? Sorry, didn't Obama go into the briefing room that day and talk about it and be like, you know, I called him and I said, you know, put John on the phone, and they wouldn't put him on the phone. I'm just remembering now that that briefing room performance. I mean, it was sort of sad, and you get the feeling that that Boehner had ghosted on Obama.
He ghosted on Obama. He absolutely did. And Obama came out and gave this, you know, remarkable press conference where basically he's like, I am a spurned lover. The relationship is dead, and so is the grand bargain.
It is hard to understand why Speaker Boehner would walk away from this kind of deal. And frankly, if you look at the commentary out there, there are a lot of Republicans that are puzzled as to why it couldn't get done.
And that is exactly what happened. And you know, at that point, you know, they could never get the momentum back. Like, that was the end. That was the end of the grand bargain. There were attempts, you know, in months and weeks and years after that. I even wrote about one attempt in 2013 during the government shutdown. And really, that whole situation had soured the whole Capitol on the idea.
It seems like an important jumping off point for, you know, kind of where we've come the last 7-8 years in terms of some of, you know, dealing with these big structural things and even caring about deficit and the debt, or the idea that we need to do anything about Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Seems like there's a pretty, you know, long tail impact of, you know, what happened then in the grand bargain and where we are now, and kind of the consequences for governing and the governing style of the last few years. How do you think about that in terms of the, you know, legacy impact of the failure of the grand bargain?
I mean, I agree with you. I think the attempts to make big deals in Washington are always sort of where lawmakers and presidents want to go. They want to believe that they can lock arms and make big historic decisions. To a certain extent, we did see that with healthcare, but it was a partisan bill. We saw that recently with tax reform, but that was a partisan bill. This grand bargain was attempt to do a big bipartisan deal, and it failed spectacularly. Which, whether we like it or not, I do think that has shaped how both parties, you know, attempt to tackle big issues. It was one of the last attempts to do things on a really big bipartisan way on debt and deficits. It became almost so comical in some ways, Ben. I'm sure you remember this, like the notion, you know, people can get in a room and go golfing and then have drinks and then strike a big grand bargain. Like it became a punching, you know, became like a punchline in Washington, where it's almost like people just sort of turn their nose up at that idea that that folks can get in a room and look past their differences and get along and try to get to know each other and strike a big deal. And that, you know, we don't see that. We don't see that happen. And I would say that was the last like really high profile attempt by a House Speaker and a president to do that. And it's hard to see how that will happen anytime soon. And that certainly had an impact on governing moving forward.
Right. And it feels like we're in such a different place now politically, you know, sort of both sides of the aisle and the Democratic Party, which has obviously moved a little bit more left and more progressive. The debate is all around, you know, does the debt even matter? Do deficits even matter? They probably don't. We should absolutely never talk about any kind of cuts to social safety net programs. In fact, we should expand them greatly and go to Medicare for all and increase Social Security benefits. And then used to have Republicans who cared a lot about reducing the deficit and cutting spending, and they don't really seem to anymore. And some of that is a, you know, result of President Trump and the fact that they did this big tax cut package. Like it in some ways, you know, it's only a few years ago, and other ways to me, it feels like an entirely different era where anybody thought that we had to address structural issues. Now it seems like we don't at all. I don't know if you agree with that.
Absolutely. I mean, you saw the president right after that turn against the notion that he had to really, you know, continue to fight the fight. President Obama felt that he had made cuts, he had made concessions. There was always deep skepticism within his own inner circle in the Democratic Party at large that that's where he should be putting his time and attention on debt and deficits. And right after that deal failed, he really pivoted pretty hard back to, or just away from expending any more capital on that. And, you know, we haven't really seen any, you know, true discussion about our debt and deficit since, right? Like there have been attempts, but it's not what people talk about anymore. And I don't see how it'll be that anytime soon.
Yeah, certainly doesn't seem like it. All right. So what we're talking about happened, you know, close to a decade ago now, more than 5 years. Feels a lot longer than that to me. And things have changed a lot. I mean, since then, Obama's become a private citizen. John Boehner is now a marijuana lobbyist. Eric Cantor got tossed out of Congress in a primary and is now an investment banker. So, Carrie, what about you? What are you doing now?
I happen to run a little publication called Politico. Yes, I'm the editor of Politico. So there you go. From the debt ceiling fights to Politico editor.
To the heights of Politico. Yeah, Carrie is now my boss and the absolute superb editor of Politico, who has seen an enormous amount in her political career and is also, like me, a Gen Xer, which is something that we're talking about a lot on this podcast. And I wonder if you could help settle a debate that I've been having with a lot of people, both on Twitter and on this podcast. And that is the question of whether Barack Obama was, in fact, the first Gen X president. I argue that he was, and you can argue it from the date of his birth, 1961, which some say would make him, you know, a very young baby boomer. I think it kind of crosses the line to Gen X there. And to me, his personality seems a lot more Gen X than it does baby boom. But I don't know. What do you think about that? Do you think of Obama as a fellow Gen Xer, or do you not care, or what do you think?
I would say I've never given it thought, Ben, but I have to agree with you. He's a Gen Xer.
Really?
Totally. Totally a Gen Xer. Yeah. I mean, he just is. There's nothing about his personality that suggests he's a baby boomer. So I don't think there's a question. Who argues that he's a baby boomer? Yeah. A lot of people?
Baby boomers. No, baby boomers want to claim him, or at least, you know, Democrat baby boomers want to claim him.
Well, inarguably a Gen Xer. There's nothing about him that's baby boom to me. Right?
I agree with that. I mean, all his right. musical tastes, kind of the way he dresses and operates. You know, he's not somebody who is, you know, constantly craving attention in the spotlight and, you know, being the center of everything. Not that he doesn't have an ego. I mean, anybody who's president has
that guy's
ego
got an ego.
You know,
believe me,
he got an ego. Exactly. No. And so do I. So do you. I mean, we're Gen Xers. We can have ego, but it's just different. You know, like it's not. It's hard to put into words to me. But he's not the me generation. He's not like Bill Clinton is the quintessential baby boomer, mm-hmm. and Obama is as different from Bill Clinton as I think it's possible to be in terms of personal kind of the way he lives his life and you know, personal behavior and all the rest of it. You know, so
totally.
To me, he's like. I don't know how you can think of him as a boomer, but so anyway, I was sort of thinking about that in terms of his relationship with John Boehner and whether mm-hmm. there was kind of a generational thing at play here. And Boehner, I guess we call a baby boomer. I mean, he's of that demographic. And at least for me, like I've always had difficulty relating to baby boomers as, you know, as bosses or as colleagues. Like I think there's a Gen X baby boomer thing where, you know, folks just don't necessarily jibe. We have different approaches to the world. But, you know, as you mentioned before, Obama and Boehner really kind of did groove together. I mean, they got on together. They did that funny video for the White House Correspondents' Dinner where they're eating popcorn and joking about getting a grand bargain, and Boehner's trying to tempt Obama to smoke a cigarette. I feel like there was a connection there that belied their generational differences. I mean, you talked about this already, but mm-hmm. there was this kind of synergy between them, right?
No, I agree with that. And I think it maybe has even more to do with just sort of their political demeanor. Barack Obama was always somebody who felt like he wanted no drama. Obama wanted to be seen as like a rational actor. And I think to a certain extent, Boehner wanted to be seen in the same way. He was sort of a pragmatist in the House. He would work across the aisle. I think Barack Obama always craved that, you know, that accomplishment of getting a big bipartisan accomplishment. He rose up in politics by saying, you know, we're not red states or blue states, we're you know, one United States of America. And I think he saw in John Boehner a possibility to sort of live up to that by trying to tackle big issues on a bipartisan basis. So I think there was like a kinship in that way that sort of drew them together. But, you know, the political forces were stronger than they were. And they couldn't do it on their own, just as two people in a room. And I think they both wished they could. But, you know, Washington thought that was silly, really. And, you know, they couldn't succeed at it.
Yeah, I mean, I think of the general Gen X approach to life as, you know, being that sort of just, you know, get stuff done, do what you need to do. Don't do it with a whole lot of drama and bringing, you know, all sorts of crazy attention on yourself all the time. And I feel like Boehner kind of fit into that, and it strikes against what generation he actually was. And there, you know, the Republicans were like that. And that's some of the stuff I've always really liked about Boehner is that he didn't want to mess around with the debt limit. He didn't want to mess around with shutdowns and do all sorts of scary stuff that might upset the economy. But, you know, mm-hmm. to deal with a really restive caucus who wanted a lot of that stuff. Anyway, I could blather on about Obama and Boehner and their bromance and the generational impact of it. But I know you as a Politico editor have a lot of other stuff to do, and there's stuff going on in the news. But I would just ask you lastly, you know, do you see any hope in the near term for any of this reoccurring, like, you know, people getting into a room and deciding, okay, look, we've gone from, at this time, we were talking about $14 trillion in debt when all this was happening. Now we've got $22 trillion in debt and a debt to GDP ratio that's okay now, but it's not going to be okay when we hit recession, and it's really going to be problematic over the long term. But you know, the power in the Democratic Party says it doesn't matter. The Republicans are, you know, very much interested in other issues on immigration and other stuff. Like, it feels like we're at a moment where there is no chance of any kind of grand bargain reoccurring in the near term, and that at some point it's just going to fall to, you know, either the remnants of Gen X plus millennials and Gen Z down the road to address any of this stuff. And it's just not going to be a focus of Washington for mm-hmm. the near term.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. I've long been sort of pessimistic about, you know, Washington and its ability to do stuff. I covered the healthcare bill from start to finish in 2009 to 10. I mean, that only happened because it was one party. And like I said, tax reform happened because it was one party. It's just extraordinarily difficult to see any time in the next 4 to 8 years, or and who knows after that, where you could see a big, tough challenge like this being tackled on a bipartisan basis. I mean, I see almost no chance, which is a pessimistic way to end this interview. But
well, yeah, it is.
I guess if you believe in bipartisanship, it's a pessimistic way. But maybe, you know, in sort of we're in an environment where, you know, it's a different political environment.
Yeah, then it's not going to be a bipartisan thing that fixes this. It's just going to be, you know, one side or the other figuring out that there's a different way to do it unilaterally. Who knows? A tumultuous time. But mm-hmm. it's not a super optimistic way to end the interview. But I will end it by saying that Carrie Budoff Brown is editor of Politico, fellow Gen Xer, tremendous journalist, a good friend, and we are very thankful that you took a little time to talk to us.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you, Ben.
That's it for Baby Bus this week. Next week, finally, an interview with an actual millennial. And not just any millennial.
Now, I think generational change doesn't have to mean generational conflict, but I do think that you have a different sense of urgency around these issues if you're expecting in your lifetime to be dealing with them personally.
This is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and 2020 Democratic contender Pete Buttigieg. Subscribe for free wherever you listen to podcasts. This episode was produced by Jenny Ament and Adrian Hurst. The executive producer of audio at Politico is Dave Shaw. I'm Ben White. Thanks for listening.